To get a view out the screen in the deck hold's narrow air vent, Daniel DiCiprio had to press his temple against the ceiling and crane his neck at a painful angle. The 20th century Freezy and author of 29 published novels could hear the wild victory celebration outside, but he couldn't see any of it. The view out the bug-proofed air vent was entirely blocked by the bow of the tug moored closely behind. Despondent, Daniel slumped back to the floor of his 5x5x5 cell and hung his head at his hands. There would have been no great victory in Deathlands without him, yet no one knew or cared about his contribution to the campaign. His thoughts slipped into a deep, dark, and familiar groove. More than a century earlier, before Armageddon, while still a ghostwriter on the Slaughter Realms pulp action series, DiCiprio struggled alone and under poor light with 100,000-word deadlines. While the SR editorial staff took latte and croissant breaks, he lived on water and corn dogs. Instead of winter vacationing in the Bahamas, driving company cars, carrying company credit cards, the lowly ghost expeditioned to the corner 7-Eleven on foot and paid for his hot dogs and loose change. In his previous life, he had lived below ground, in a nasty two-room basement apartment in the flatlands of Berkeley, California. The concrete walls sweated. He sweated. His above-ground neighbors, all rich college students and professors, mocked him and called him the Mole Man to his face. All Daniel DiCiprio really had was his devotion to writing, his art. To further it, and to break the economic and social bonds that kept him from reaching his full creative potential, he had volunteered for ultra-secret lab rat duty in the jungles of Panama in the hope that the experience would give him something truly original and important to write about and allow him to stake his claim to fame and wealth. Long before Nuke Day's dawn, things had gone very wrong on the remote prison island. During the course of the black box-funded experiments, his blood became infected with an engineered virus of unheard-of and unstoppable lethality, but to which he was immune. He had been offered a choice by the facility's whitecoats to live out the rest of his life in isolation on the island hellhole or go into cryogenic sleep until a cure could be found. When he was reanimated more than 100 years later, he was shocked to learn that there was still no cure for the virus in his blood, that in the interim, the civilized world had blown itself apart, and that he was to be deployed as a walking biological weapon by the 10th generation offspring of the penal colony's original rapists and murderers. Daniel lowered his forehead to his upraised knees and thumped it upon them, hard, over and over again. After all the effort he'd made and the pain he'd endured, what in his life had changed? He still got no credit for his heroic deeds, only now the body count he created was real, and he wasn't paid a penny in compensation. He still lived in a hole, only now it was under even worse conditions. He had a bucket for a toilet and no toilet paper. He ate with his fingers out of an old tin can. No TV or skin mags for companionship, no showers. Whether imprisoned below decks or walking free as a plague vector, he was still looked down upon by everyone he met. Everyone except the droolies. He'd always been able to count on the droolies. Though as far as he knew, there were no more novels of any kind being published, though he had no writing instruments or paper. That didn't stop him from attempting to compose great works of destiny in his mind. But unhappily, no matter the starting point, all his epic original ideas eventually turned into Slaughter Realms books. No matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get the series and the characters out of his head. Perhaps it was a function of having written so many of them? Or perhaps cryogenesis had permanently damaged his creative synapses? Sooner or later, the characters started to banter and jive like the series' regulars. instead of the vast, labyrinthine conspiracies he'd envisioned himself writing, the stories devolved into highly detailed sword and gunfights, and the occasional extraneous, space-filling sexual romp. Heads parted company with necks, cranial contents Jackson Pollock opposing mud-plastered walls and ceilings, bowels tumbled steaming from the torsos in fat gray coils, and sweat-lubricated bodies writhed in ecstasy and exploded in impossible joy. His 137 years of existence had been nothing less than a classic wall-to-wall fuck-up. More pain and suffering awaited him because his lifeblood was still valuable to his masters. Or to be more specific, the marrow in his bones was valuable. Daniel was the only plague vector who'd survived the Deathlands adventure. All the other fire talkers, gaudy sluts, and traveling tinkers had perished, either at the hands of the enemy or thanks to an overabundance of friendly fire. Without their infected ones, called Enanos, the Lords of Death couldn't maintain their stranglehold on the Central American city-states. For their part, the Mattachine didn't care how many of the Enanos died, or how it happened. The only accounting of casualties came from Commander Cascampo, and he could make up any story that suited him. The Lords of Death had elevated themselves to godhood by being the first to control the plague and then apply it to the battlefield. Daniel felt a lurch of movement as the tug turned away from the pier, starting the next leg of his long journey back to hell. At Blaster Point, Ryan, leading the string of chained slaves, passed through the iron gate, which opened onto a narrow, dank stone corridor. The passage was lit by a string of bare, dim bulbs draped along the ridge of the ceiling. Ryan guessed the walls were at least 5 or 6 feet thick, thick enough to stop a 16th-century cannonball. When Ryan, Cascampo, and their escort exited the corridor's far end, they stepped out into the corner of a huge courtyard. Harsh light from the battlements illuminated the long colonnades on either side. On the left, the structure was faced with red brick. On the right, it was naked limestone. Through the room-sized arches on that side, Ryan could see the exterior wall and the gated entrance to the fort's dock. The three masts of a large sailing ship were visible above it. Stretching out before them was a grassy sward. A two-story building blocked the far end, its rows of tall windows overlooking the courtyard. Immense, sculpted stone heads of the various Atapools guarded the colonnade's entrances, 10 heads to a side, glaring across the sward at one another. As Ryan walked on, he saw evidence of other recent human sacrifices. Fist-sized gobbets of blackening flesh lay on the ground at the base of each of the idols. Egg-sized hearts, 20 of them in all. Along the left-hand wall were the rest of the remains, torsos in one heap, heads in another. It smelled like a charnel house, and there wasn't a breath of wind to stir the death stench inside the compound. A group of 8 men awaited them in front of the building at the end of the courtyard. 7 were robed and head-dressed priests, led by none other than the hairless spider himself. Ryan glanced up at the battlements on either side, 3 stories above. They were lined with red sashes. Close to 300 of the sect men, he reckoned. All armed, all looked down at the spectacle. The pirate commander advanced the last 20 feet by himself. Ignoring the priests, he knelt in front of the 8th man, who apparently outranked them all. At first, Ryan thought the guy was wearing an elaborate mask over his face. Then he realized it was his face. The corners of the man's mouth had been surgically extended deep into his cheeks, and the lips excised top and bottom, this to reveal inch-and-a-half-long fangs of gold where his canine teeth had once been. It gave him a permanent, awful, stylized grin, like the Atapool heads. Saliva spilled from the corners of his vast, carved mouth, gooey, yo-yoing strands drooling onto his gilded battle armor. Evenly spaced welts of purple, scarified tissue bridged his nose and cheeks. making them look corrugated, like a boar's snout. Unlike the Atapul representations, his tongue wasn't pointed or a foot long. His high-piled dreads were caged in a ceremonial headdress. The breastplate of his gilded battle armor was spattered with drops of fresh blood. At a hand signal from the pirate captain, the Mattachine pushed Ryan forward, then kicked him behind the knees to make him kneel before their headman's headman.
I am the governor of the city-state of Veracruz. I am Generalissimo Almodo. The capture of you and Hunapu are a sign of the turning point in a war waged by the lords of death since the day of creation. You will be tried by the religious tribunal tomorrow and then executed before the following dawn. Take the others.
Ryan glowered at the priests as his friends were hauled away. Doc looked back at him.
I pray we meet again, my dear friend. If not in the here and now, then somewhere beyond this fucking veil of tears.
Remember the Islander boy. Remember Garwood Reed.
Yeah! Oh!
Ryan looked up at Modo and saw his bald, metal-gauntleted fist.
Unchain me for a minute, and I'll widen that smile all the way to the back of your head.
The Governor General sneered and gestured to the pirates, who pulled Ryan to his feet and hauled him off to one side. Modo had other, more pressing business to attend to. He snapped his gauntleted fingers in Casacampo's direction. The Mattachine commander took a small, dog-eared notebook from inside his armor, the priests touching up the edges on their ceremonial daggers on whetstones. Casacampo walked over to the line of slaves. Pausing in front of the first man, who was naked to the waist, his back and shoulders blistered and peeling from the sun and the lash, the captain referred to a page in his little book, then made a check mark with the tiny stub of a pencil. When he nodded, the crewman unhooked the captive from those waiting behind him. Before the poor bastard could make a break for it, the pirates grabbed him under the armpits and rushed him toward Modo and the waiting priests. Though the slave fought and tried to dig in his heels, it was to no avail. The Mattachine carried him boldly the last 15 feet, then flung him to his knees in front of the men in robes. A priest stepped forward and expertly dispatched him with a backhanded knife slash across his throat. Kneeling, the priest plundered the still-heaving chest for its precious clod of muscle. No sooner than the gruesome butcher job was done, a second slave was unhooked and bum-rushed to a nearly identical death. As Ryan watched, the priests took turns in the chilling duties so as not to overtax themselves. All but the hairless spider, who was doing a little shuffle-foot dance behind them.
No! No, please! Please, no!
Casacampo made another check mark in his little book before consigning a fourth prisoner to the same fate.
Fuck you! Rot in nuke hell, you bastards!
Alarmed, Ryan wondered if they were going to kill all the slaves. His companions were still a good ways back in the file. For the first time, he saw the possibility that he might actually outlive them, spared from death for another day. And worse, that he would be forced to stand by and watch them all slaughtered. Realizing what was coming, all of the slaves struggled futilely with their bonds. All but the companions. Jack, Christy, Mildred, Doc, and JB were staring at Ryan. Their fixed, defiant expressions all said the same thing. We're not going to check out like that. Not like chickens on the chopping block. The one-eyed warrior nodded in agreement. Then he looked away. The hairless spider was gathering dripping lumps of muscle in a wicker basket as Casacampo stepped up to Jack, who was next in line for sacrifice. Ryan knew the pirates weren't going to discount the albino because of his size or muty appearance. Just the opposite. They'd already seen him in action with a commandeered machete. One of them put a submachine gun muzzle to the back of Jack's head before they unfastened his ankle chains from the others.
Put him to the side.
Ryan planned to make his play the moment the pirates started to rush Jack forward to his doom. When they pulled the albino youth to the side instead, he held back.
And this man also, the two women to the side.
They were then rechained together at the ankles. After JB was linked to the others, the next slave in line, to his surprise and dismay, got dragged to the priests. The companions glanced at Ryan again, wanting the go signal. He shook his head. It looked like they weren't going to be slaughtered along with the rest. It appeared their captors had other plans for them, which changed everything as far as he was concerned. A pirate approached Casacampo with a heavy, blanket-wrapped bundle. The captain nodded, and the pirate untied it and laid it out on the ground at Moto's feet. When the bundle was opened, Ryan saw it held his scoped Steyr long blaster, JB's scattergun, and the rest of their weapons. Trophies of conquest, or maybe objects of ridicule. Casacampo waved the blaster bearer ahead of him, through a white stone archway toward the dock and sailing ship beyond. Surrounded by Mattachine, Christy, Jack, Mildred, Doc, and JB were then shoved in that direction. They looked back over their shoulders at Ryan one last time, still awaiting his signal for them to act. He shook his head, a final emphatic no, and also a goodbye. The companions disappeared from sight. Ryan's pirate escort spun him the opposite way and forced him to walk under the red brick colonnade. They followed a dimly lit passage that led through the fort's exterior wall and out the door of a cylindrical guard post. In front of Ryan was a floodlit stone bridge, wider and more ornate than the first he'd crossed, and twice as long. This one was painted pale yellow and decorated with stout pairs of pillars at both ends. It led to a separate island, which was completely covered by a ravelin half as large as the courtyard they'd just left. The three-story structure was shaped like a triangle or an arrowhead pointing away from the bridge. Above the arched entryway were more crenellated battlements. There were only two windows that Ryan could see. The rest was smooth, featureless stone. There was no doubt in Ryan's mind that what lay at the far end of the bridge was the epicenter of the bad juju he'd sensed earlier. As they mounted the bridge, Ryan considered and rejected his options. Even though it was way easier for one man to slip through a crack than six, the pirates had him cold. At least, for the moment. The pirates marched him through the prison entrance and into a stone-walled anteroom. A half-dozen red-sashed guards awaited his arrival. Two of them immediately took up long wooden poles, which had metal hoops attached to one end. While the Mattachine pinioned his arms and two red sashes aimed double barrels at his chest, the poles were extended, front and rear, and the hoops slipped over his head and down past his chin. The red sashes then pulled on straps at the ends of the poles, drawing the steel bands so tight around his throat that he could barely breathe. When the Mattachine released his arms, the men holding the poles were in total control of him. With a pole-bearing red sash in front and one behind, Ryan was simultaneously pushed and pulled forward through a floor-to-ceiling iron gate. He entered a labyrinth of stone and stifling heat and humidity. The walls and floors were warped and worn. There were standing puddles of unidentifiable fluid everywhere. To his left were rows of passages, presumably the cell blocks, stretching off into the dark. When they passed by one of the cramped cells, Ryan saw it had no bed. It had no water, no toilet, no window to let in air or natural light. It reeked of urine and rotting flesh. A human form lay huddled and hidden under a pile of rags on the damp stone floor. There were rats inside the cell. They were merrily burrowing under the rags, feeding on the dead or the nearly dead prisoner. When Ryan looked farther down the passage, in the faint light he saw rats scurrying in bands of a dozen or more, darting back and forth across the corridor between the cells. They continued on until they reached the very heart of the darkness, the place that was the hottest, the rankest, the most oppressive, the core of the man-made hellhole. With double barrels pointed at his head, Ryan was uncollared and booted into an already occupied cell. The iron-barred gate slammed shut behind him. Their work done, the red sashes turned away and left him to get acquainted with his cellmate. The other prisoner squatted with his back pressed into a corner, his head lowered, his long black hair hanging down over his face. He appeared to be naked except for his chains. The weak light from the single overhead bulb threw him in deep shadow. As Ryan took in the bleak cell, he noticed the stalagmites on the floor, white calcite that had dripped from the ceiling.
Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
What the fuck?
The words seemed to have come from behind him. Ryan whirled, but there was no one there, only the sweating limestone wall. When he turned back, the deadpan expression of the man who was his mirror image had transformed into a wide grin. The companions were force-marched across the stone dock toward the waiting black schooner.
We've got to do something. We can't let these evil bastards chill him.
Now leave Ryan here.
Jack, Christy, what, pray tell, are our other options at present? We cannot rescue him if we cannot rescue ourselves.
Mildred thought about that and leaned closer to JV.
We need a window of opportunity to turn things in our favor. Got any ideas?
A lowering of the red blasted odds would be an excellent start.
We still have time. We could...
Silencio!
Casacampo mounted the gangway first and strode onto the aft deck of the black schooner. There to greet them was a tall, thin man and two short, round women. All of them wore clean, starched white coats. They smiled hopefully as the Matachin stepped up to them. Casacampo dismissed the trio with an impatient wave. He brushed past the white coats without a word, stepped down into the cockpit, and disappeared below decks. Doc raised an eyebrow at that.
Whatever the captain's new mission is, he does not seem to particularly relish it.
The white-coat man waved his prisoners and their pirate escort aboard. The black ship was much bigger than Tempest, easily twice as long, and half again as wide across the beam. The hull was riveted metal plate. The masts and superstructure were made of wood. When the companions were assembled along the starboard rail, the male white-coat stepped forward. He had slicked back black hair and a profile dominated by a long, hawkish nose.
I am a doctor. My name is Montejo. These ladies are my assistants. I realize you have been through a terrible ordeal. It is our job to restore you to full health and vigor.
Do you believe this nuke shit? For almost a month they do their damnedest to chill us, and now they want to take care of us?
The question is why?
Whatever the reason for the change of attitude, we've got to play along with it, at least temporarily.
I concur wholeheartedly. This presents a golden opportunity to take our own back.
The white coats led them down the companionway's steel steps. The Matachin escort followed behind, their weapons ready. Overhead, generator-powered light bulbs and metal cages faded in and out, from intensely bright to dim. Aft of the stairs, across the width of the stern, was the captain's cabin. In front of them, under a low sheet metal ceiling, was the ship's mess. A long metal-topped table was bracketed by bench seats. The floor was worn linoleum. Immediately they were enveloped by cooking smells from the galley. Meat, beans, onions, garlic, and savory spices. The aroma made Jack's mouth water and his head swim.
Smelled like good grub. Maybe the white coat wasn't lying about the food after all.
See if we get any of it this time.
Beyond the mess, a bulkhead door opened onto a narrow corridor lined with riveted steel doors. Each door had a peephole on the outside so anyone in the corridor could look into the rooms. The pirates began to separate Christy and Mildred from the others.
Where are you taking us?
The white coat doctor smiled at her. The expression in his hooded eyes was romantic. Mildred tried to keep the alarm from her eyes.
You two lovely ladies have been assigned a separate cabin for your comfort and privacy. Each stateroom has its own toilet and sink.
While Doc, Jack, and JB waited at the corridor, Mildred and Christy were ushered into a room on the right side by the female whitecoats and three of the pirate guards. As the doorway was blocked by the male bodies, Doc couldn't see what was going on inside. After a few moments, the whitecoats and pirate guard came out. Dr. Monteo pulled the door shut behind him and shot the slide bolts, top and bottom. Then Dr. Monteo opened a door on the left and waved for them to enter. JB stared into a low-ceilinged, windowless steel box, roughly 10x8, illuminated by a pair of caged light bulbs. There were three built-in bunks along the left-hand wall, and a sink and a low, lidless toilet on the opposite side.
Beats the rowing bench all to hell.
The pirates roughly pushed them into the small room.
For pity's sake, careful there.
The connecting chain was removed, leaving their ankle and hand manacles in place. Jack shook his wrist chains in the doctor's face.
How about taking these off? Like to wipe my own butt.
I deeply apologize for the continuing security measures and assure you from the bottom of my heart that they are only temporary. As soon as everything is secure, the ship will be leaving Veracruz. Then you will have much more freedom. Now, you must be hungry. You will be fed shortly. After that, you will receive a complete physical examination and your wounds will be properly dressed.
The smiling Monteo and the scowling pirates backed out of the cramped room. The door slammed, and the locking bolts clacked shut.
Trust no whitecoat. They are lying fuckers.
Well, you'll get no argument from me on that, dear boy. I'd just as soon see them food for crows, dangling by their overstretched necks from every incandescent light pole.
Shh! Listen! A count. 10. Maybe more. Not sure.
If the rest of the bastards got off the ship, our odds are looking better. How many bodies does it take to crew a tub like this? Doc, do you know? When the time comes, how many are we going to be up against?
If memory serves, even a skeleton crew to run a ship this size would be 7 or 8 sailors, not including the captain. That would be the minimum, and it would entail hard duty for all, around the clock.
The ship's auxiliary diesel engine started up with a rumble. After a moment, the heavy mooring line thudded onto the deck above the companion cell, and then the vessel slowly backed away from the dock.
Where'd they take us?
My guess is that it has to be south, deeper into Matachin territory. I can't think of a reason for them to want to ferry us back north.
Doc took a seat on the edge of the bottom bunk and stared at his own blurred reflection in the polished metal wall. Looking closer, he noted that its surface was covered with crude graffiti. Proper names, obscene phrases in Spanish, obscene cartoons. All apparently scratched into the soft steel with the edges of handcuffs. Wherever they were being taken in chains, they were not the first. The ship picked up speed as it set course for the harbor entrance. JB put his ear against the bulkhead wall opposite the bunks. When he pulled his head back, he glanced at Doc and Jack.
Someone's in the cell next door.
I don't hear nothing.
This may help in that regard.
Doc stood and reached for the narrow air vent set in the wall near the ceiling. He slid back the metal cover on its racks.
Why can't you get it through your thick heads? I'm trying to explore the limits of moral responsibility and personal faith in an epical context. Every time you three pop up in the mix, that exploration comes to a screeching halt.
Stark Dance, you unmitigated hack! You're telling us we're not good enough to flesh out your philosophical digressions, but we were damn good enough to put food on your kitchen table for years!
Yeah, Alpo and Bubble Bread. Perhaps the fault isn't with us, but rather with you. After all, we're just stock fictional characters with half-page bios. You've always been in control of what we do and say. Empty canvases. We are what you make of us. Perhaps you, the author, lack the skill, the depth of introspection, and native intelligence to animate us in any other way?
Oofta! Once again, the gorgeous princess is talking through her shapely buckskin-clad backside. I, Ragnar, am no mere puppet. I am warlord of Northland.
Are you looking to get your head and pigtails hacked off, Viking?
No, stop, stop! Can't you see I'm searching for something important? Something that will stand the test of time. Something eternal. Some kind of moral certitude. Evidence of a divine hand in all things. The hope and nobility of humankind. And all you want to do is fight.
Jack hooked a thumb at the wall.
How many locked up in there?
Just the one soul, I believe. He's doing all the voices himself. Falsetto, baritone, tenor. Not a very convincing job either, I might add.
Hey, wait just a nukin' minute. I know those names. They're from those books Harmonica Tom had lined up on a shelf in Tempest. The Slaughter Realms series. Remember, I opened one of them and read some of it to everyone. It was so bad, Christy made me stop. It sounds like someone else has got their hands on one of these books and is reading it out loud.
The excess of verbiage does sound familiar. Almost as if the author was being paid strictly by the word.
Draw your steel, you walking, talking vegetable, and I will chop you into water salad.
Advance another step forward, Ragnar, and I'll have your fire-furred goobers dangling from my cinch waist.
Not if I take one of your firm-up thrusties for a coin purse.
Shut the fuck up!
Why should I? If you're on the other side of that wall, you're in chains and no threat to me.
Behind the lenses of his spectacles, JB's eyes opened wide in recognition.
Fire talker.
Are you reading from a book?
I'm not reading. I'm composing dialogue out loud. That way the ear can pick up the ebb and flow of natural speech. Besides, I lack paper and pen to set things down in a more permanent fashion. I'll have you know, I'm an author of considerable repute.
You mean for Slaughter Realms?
You know the series, then?
Who doesn't know Ragnar and the Indian Princess?
It ran to more than 250 titles, I believe. Not even Armageddon could wipe all the copies off the face of the earth.
Most gratifying to know that body of work still lives on.
On the other side of the wall, Doc and JB buried their mouths against their arms to keep the laughter from being heard. From the void of expression in Jack's ruby-red eyes, it was impossible to tell whether he fully understood the joke.
How did you come to live so long? Are you a time traveler?
After a fashion. I went into cryostasis before Nuke Day.
So you're a freezy?
Not intentionally. Out of a deep sense of patriotism, I volunteered and was chosen to participate in a super-secret experiment. In the course of unforeseen tragic events, I ended up in a cryo tank.
The ship's almost imperceptible forward passage suddenly changed. Clearing the protection of the harbor's breakwater, the bow began gently rising and falling as it crossed the widely spaced Atlantic swells. The engine kept rumbling. There was evidently not enough wind for the pirates to raise sail. A point of no return lay some hours ahead of them, Doc knew. A point after which they couldn't reverse course and still make it back in time to save Ryan. They had to act, to overpower the captain and crew and take command of the ship before they passed that critical point. Meanwhile, the joke they were playing on the traitor Daniel had lost a good deal of its edge. Then the door of the companion cell opened, and the plump little white-coated women entered bearing trays with large covered ceramic bowls. Amazing aromas entered with them. With a flourish and twinkling black eyes, the white coats uncovered the bowl's brimming contents. Doc gazed down on a thick red stew dotted with islands of little cornmeal dumplings. Was that slow-cooked pork or boneless breast of chicken floating in the broth? Maybe both? Certainly he could see black beans, rice, squash of some sort, chopped up red and green chilies, and what looked like sprigs of cilantro. Sprinkled on top was a pungent, soft, and crumbly white cheese. One of the women handed him his bowl and then gave him a big metal spoon to eat with. In the process, some of the red gravy got smeared on the pink ball of her thumb. She licked it off and rolled her eyes in delight.
Mmm.
You are a true angel of mercy, my dear lady.
Even though the stew was scalding hot, it was difficult to keep from wolfing it down. Beaming with delight, the white coats backed out of the room, then closed and rebolted the door. Daniel DiCipio carefully fished a walnut-sized cornmeal dumpling from his stew with the tip of his spoon. He deposited it on his tongue, shut his eyes, and let it slowly melt in his mouth. Rapture. This was the lap of luxury. A cell with a flush toilet and a ceiling tall enough for him to stand up in. A bunk with a mattress to sleep on. Food that didn't make him gag and then come squirting out his nose.
Where are we being taken?
I don't know any more than you do.
Why were we chosen? And all the other galley slaves slaughtered.
Sorry, don't have a clue about that either.
Is the food always this good here?
Don't know. This is the first I've had of it.
Daniel could have told them the truth about everything, exactly what was going to happen to them, the precise order of events, and why. He could have tortured his neighbors with the gruesome details, making them endure the rest of the voyage in horror and trembling dread. But he restrained himself. Knowledge was the only power he had. No way would he give it up for nothing. Daniel was already beginning to feel the effects of the food, a spreading, delicious warmth and heaviness through his limbs and chest, a dryness in his mouth, sleepiness, some difficulty concentrating. He didn't know what the ship's cooks used, some kind of tasteless, odorless opiate, most likely. A precise dose based on estimated body weight was mixed in with each bowl of delicious grub, grub that had to be gobbled. For his part, Daniel had always enjoyed the drug's effect. He found it made the voyage to Xibalba pass even more pleasantly, as in a dream. Doped up with a satisfyingly full belly, a real bed to sleep on, no one trying to chill you, no one abusing you, and no thoughts about the pain and suffering to come. The latter because under the drug's influence there was no way to hold a coherent thought in your head, not even one of terror. He slowly chewed a last succulent morsel of pork. But at least it wasn't Alpo. Setting aside the bowl, he curled up to sleep until breakfast.
Snapjacks and bacon with a big old side of stupefy. Yum.
The smiling man who was Ryan's mirror image stood up from the floor of the cell. His naked body was streaked with caked-on filth. About an inch shorter than Carter, he had the same rangy, powerful build and shoulder-length black curly hair. Up close and face-to-face, the resemblance was not so startling, Ryan decided. The man's nose was wider, as were the cheekbones. His chin was narrower and a bit less rugged. The man's skin was much darker than Ryan's, reflecting perhaps some Indio heritage. Although the black eye patch was similar, the surviving eye he stared into was not sky blue. It was a deep brown, almost black. The jagged welt of a scar that divided the ruined eye socket ran close to horizontal, starting on the forehead above the bridge of the nose and curving down around the top of the cheek. Ryan's scar, on the other hand, was nearly vertical, slicing straight down from above the eyebrow.
Who the hell are you?
The priests have convinced the Red Sashes and most of the campesinos that I'm the flesh of your flesh, your brother, Hunapu.
You're no brother of mine.
No, of course not. But it suits the priests and their distant masters if everyone believes they've captured the living embodiment of the fabled hero twins, Hunapu and Xibalanque.
Who might they be?
Part of the ancient Mayan story of the beginning of the world. The original hero twins, one Hunapu and seven Hunapu, were the third creation of the gods of the universe. They were killed and dismembered by the Lords of Death. Their offspring, Hunapu and Xibalanque, avenged the murders through trickery and magic, and in so doing, consigned the 12 lords and all their subject devils to the underworld, thereby limiting their power to do harm to innocent beings. A more recent myth
devised by the Atapuls and their priests, claims that Nukde undid the Hero Twins' 5,000-year-old victory and opened the gates to hell. Since then, so the story goes, the Lords of Death have roamed free on Earth in the form of the Atapuls. They and their devils spread plague, pestilence, war, and suffering in their wake. The story presents two opposing forces. One offers light to the world, the other darkness. My people believe the Hero Twins are humanity's last remaining hope because they beat the Lords of Death once before and held them in check for 5,000 years. If the Atapu clan and their priests can convince everyone that they have killed the forces of light, that hope is gone. When you and I die in public view, they believe the growing resistance to their rule will crumble, and they will reign unchallenged over humankind forever.
If you aren't Hunapu, then who the fuck are you? And where did you learn to speak English?
I'm called Chucho. I've been an outlaw with a price on my head for more than 10 years now. I was first imprisoned by priests in Cancun, another of the Atapul city-states, for a crime I didn't commit. They did this so they could rob my family and take everything that was ours. While I was locked away in prison, they killed all my relatives and moved into our house and onto our lands. Cancun's prison was full of very bad men who taught me to rob and to murder, and how to do it well. When I had learned all I could from them, I found a way to escape. Within days, I fell in with a dramatic troupe that traveled from town to town along the coast. The actor showed me how to disguise myself, how to throw my voice, how to do magic tricks, how to pickpocket. One of them taught me your language.
Chucho held up his handcuffs for Ryan to see.
No keyhole. No bolt either. They are welded shut. There is no lock made that I can't pick. And they keep me naked so I can't hide weapons under my clothes. Out on the road, I'd carry as many as 5 blasters at once. In holsters, pockets, boots, my hat, taped against my skin. The red sashes sometimes got lucky and caught me at a checkpoint or on the street. After collecting 3 or 4 pistols, they would give up the search, figuring they had them all. Before they knew it, I'd have a little .22 belly gun going pop, 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 point blank into their heads. I killed 6 of the bastards and walked away from the stockade of a fortified garrison up north. After that happened, they got smarter. I've been caught 6 times since then and condemned to death 6 times, but I always found a way to escape before the sentence could be carried out. And when I returned to their world, I made the bastards pay, and I took pleasure in it. The priests put a bounty on my head in gold, and every year I was free, they raised it higher. Even so, no one ever turned me in. The people wrote songs about me instead, and they still sing them in the cantinas when there are no red sashes around.
Songs?
Of celebration, because I killed their oppressors, stole treasure from the Lords of Death. And all that I stole, I gave back to the people robbed and brutalized by the priests and red sashes. What I did was something the people will never forget. Or the priests, or their masters, for that matter. Last spring, there was an uprising in one of the western provinces. The silver miners there went on a rampage, killing the red sashes with shovels and picks, and burning down their garrison. Because I happened to be there, and was seen helping in the fighting, the priests blamed it all on me. That's when they started calling me Hunapu and began circulating the rumors about the Hero Twins coming to life and waging final war on the Lords of Death.
Well, I've heard a lot of bullshit in my time, but I saw giant papier-mâché models of your head on sticks. You don't get your head waved around on a pole if you're a nobody. And you're locked away in the deepest, darkest hole of this stinking shit pit of a prison with handcuffs welded shut and bare-assed on top of that. So I guess I believe you. Don't trust you, though. Not yet. No reason to.
True. And you who are not my brother, what is your name? What did you do to end up here? You come from Tierra de la Muerte?
The name's Ryan. You're right. I come from Deathlands. I got trapped in the wrong place at the wrong time, doing a little trading. Pirates took me and my partners for slaves. Made us row down here.
And you had the terrible misfortune to look like me, only in reverse.
Yeah. Some things can't be helped.
You have traveled down many hard roads. I can see it in the eye you still have left. I see many dead. I see destruction.
I've been blamed for some bad things I didn't do, just like you.
I think in Tierra de la Muerte, the bastards who prey on the weak have nightmares about you coming to visit. So perhaps we are related after all.
How long have you been a prisoner here?
Weeks. And I still haven't found a way out. This rebellion is escape-proof, so they say. The stone walls are 6 feet thick. They can't be tunneled through. The floor is even thicker. It runs straight down into bedrock coral. No one has ever escaped from this prison alive. The dead live here in wheelbarrows every day. Maybe if I had another month, I might be able to figure a way out. But we don't have that much time. We die before dawn the day after tomorrow.
What about the trial?
If you're thinking you might get justice from these animals, you can forget it. They don't know the meaning of the word. The trial is a sham, a chance for the priests to chant and burn incense and wear their judge hats in public. They want to get the execution over and done with as quickly as possible, so I don't slip away again. It's funny, even though they're priests, they don't have much in the way of faith.
We don't have their stinking religion in Deathlands.
Not yet, but just you wait. It's been moving up the coast ever since Skydark. The people of Veracruz, the Jarochos, escaped the worst of Armageddon, only to be set upon 75 years later by the Matachin. They hit the city first with plague, then with religion and the red-sashed traitors. The sickness they brought was like nothing anyone had ever seen before. Whole neighborhoods were wiped out. And when the disease was at its peak, the pirates sailed into the bay and flattened the resistance with a relatively small number of fighters. The priests moved in right behind them with images of new gods to worship. They painted the churches the color of blood and told the people if they didn't obey their every command, the lords of death, who had been resurrected by the fires of global destruction, would bring back the plague to punish them. From that day forward, everything returned to the ancient ways at the time of creation when the lords of death ruled the world.
Wait a bastard minute. You're telling me that disease was a weapon of war? That it was turned loose on purpose?
A terrible weapon. The tidal waves of Skydark reduced the population of this city to 250,000 people. After the plague struck, the living numbered less than 50,000. The killing was indiscriminate and wholesale. Within 10 days of the outbreak, the graveyards of Veracruz overflowed. The streets were heaped high with bodies. Because of the volume of corpses and the effects of the tropical heat, they had to be put in a mass grave. We learned later how it was done. The Matachin had seeded the target cities with enanos of the Lords of Death.
I don't understand.
They sent in infected people, plague carriers, in advance of the attack to weaken the opposition with the sickness and guide the invasion.
Son of a bitch. There was this two-faced little bastard on the island where we were captured, where the sickness had struck. When we tried to escape, he turned us over to the Matachin. He had to be working for them. You're saying he was a plague carrier too? That he brought all that death with him?
I don't think there's any doubt about it.
He came back with us on the tug. The pirates kept him below decks the whole time. He never saw the light of day. Not in 3 weeks.
That's understandable. If he'd been allowed out, the disease might have killed everyone on board.
Huh. And here I thought the Matachin were keeping the stinking piece of crap down there for his safety, so the people he betrayed wouldn't tear him apart.
No, they did it to protect themselves from what he carries.
Explain something else to me, then. The disease weapon didn't chill everyone on Padre Island. From what you just said, it didn't chill everyone in Veracruz, either. Why?
The survivors either had resistance to the sickness or somehow managed to avoid being infected. Once the Matachin established military control of the city, they and their priests selected red sashes from the 50,000 who were left. They were picked for their willingness to obey orders and hurt others. There are less than 1,000 of them in Veracruz and outlying areas. The threat of the plague coming back keeps the people in line. No one wants that. Even in the countryside, people obey because of fear. Priests have churches there too, but they are really just warehouses for collecting valuables. Precious ores, fuel, and food. Everyone pays a tax to them. Otherwise, the red sashes come and take even more.
And you gave the taxes back.
With interest.
How are they going to chill us?
It won't be pretty, that's for sure. And like I said, it will be in public. Not much point in killing your fabled enemies if no one sees it.
So the executions won't be here?
No. They'll hold the trial here so the ceremony won't be interrupted. After the guilty verdict, they'll take us back into the city tomorrow night for the chilling. There will be another big parade ending at the lighthouse. They'll murder us in plain sight of every citizen of Veracruz. Then it'll be our flesh and bone heads on sticks paraded around the Zocalo. And the mob will cheer at gunpoint.
Why at night?
It's cooler. They'll draw a bigger crowd.
So our best chance of escape is after the trial, during the move.
Our best chance surrounded by 1,000 red sashes?
You're not giving up.
I've worked magic before. I just may do it again.
You don't have supporters on the outside to rescue you?
You mean take this fort by force? You must be joking. The only access is either by bridge or by water, and both are defensible from the battlements. To try to break in here is suicide.
Out of the corner of his eye, Ryan saw something move just inside the cell's iron bars. A shadow of a shadow, scooting low and fast across the floor. Without a word, Chucho suddenly whirled and side-armed a limestone pebble. Chucho stepped over to the bars and picked up the dead rat by the tail. When he held it up to the lights, its little curled-up front legs were still twitching.
Have you had your dinner, my friend?
Harmonica Tom stood in the bed of the parked pickup, bracketed by his three new amigos. They had pulled over to the shoulder of the road, unable to get any closer to the glow of the city because of the big parade creeping their way. He recognized the plague head from his own nightmares. It made his skin crawl.
How could these people possibly know what the one-eyed warrior looked like? And why, for nuke's sake, are they waving his head about?
Up the road, he could see a trio of stake trucks advancing at a snail's pace with headlights blazing on high beams. Backlit pirates in full armor and weapons marched in formation in front of the lead truck. The parade eventually passed right in front of them. At first, Tom couldn't believe his eyes. Ryan and the others had all survived the long voyage from Padre Island. They looked like they'd been through hell. Their faces were gaunt, as well as cut and bruised. They were in irons, but they were alive, and he felt a wave of relief. Tom tapped his drunk truck buddy on the shoulder and pointed at the trucks, doing his best to look like a puzzled Julie. The man waved a bottle of joy juice in the direction of the illuminated floating fortress.
San Juan de Ulua.
That made sense. Putting the surviving slaves, particularly the most dangerous ones, somewhere they couldn't escape. His drunken amigo suddenly tumbled off the tailgate of the pickup and joined the parade as the three trucks in the lead crept around a right turn toward the fort. They never even noticed. Tom didn't follow. He jumped down from the opposite side of the pickup. Nobody was looking in his direction as he cut between a pair of huge rectangular concrete pads, the foundations of warehouses that had been swept clean by Skydark's tidal waves. He headed overland at a fast trot, making a beeline for the brightly lit power station compound. Tom's knowledge of pre-dark power plants was extremely limited. He'd never seen a functional one before. When the sun went down in Deathlands, people lit fires or squatted in the dark. Years back, though, he'd come across an 18-page full-color comic book published in 1999 by Mississippi Power and Light. Solo sailing the hellscape's coast gave Tom plenty of time to read and study all the pre-dark material he managed to collect in his travels. From the cartoon schematics in the comic, he had soaked up the basic elements of large-scale steam-generated electric power. On the other side of the wide swath of hurricane fence, under the strings of lights that decorated the 12-story cooling tower and boiler complex, were rows of cylindrical holding tanks for diesel. Tanks big enough to contain 90,000 barrels of fuel each. According to the disintegrating comic book, diesel was burned to heat water to steam that was then used to turn the turbines and produce electricity. The tank farm was an obvious target for some of the C4. The heat and pressure from a plastique explosion would guarantee ignition. A raging, out-of-control oil fire would make a great distraction, and the dense smoke might help cover Tempest's exit from the harbor. But after the blaze was either put out or allowed to burn itself out, the tanks could be fairly easily replaced, and so could the fuel if there was still an operational refinery on the coast. He was looking to do some damage that would be much more long-term, perhaps even permanent. to the left of the main complex and connected to it by drooping high-tension lines suspended on a series of tall towers was the main transformer station, which converted the plant's raw energy into a form that was usable and that could be transmitted over long distances. It, too, was protected by a hurricane fence perimeter. Even if he completely flattened the step-up station, Tom decided it could be rebuilt if enough spare parts were available. He continued on to the 10-foot-high fence that surrounded the plant proper. The barrier was in a sad state of repair, rusting, with obvious makeshift entry and exit routes along its length. Shortcuts the workers used to get to and from the job site, and for local folk who didn't want to walk around the huge complex to reach the other side. Tom lifted the edge of a flap cut in the mesh and slipped through. As he approached the structure, he could see a few workers 10 stories above him on the pipe frame catwalks that encased the boiler complex. If they noticed him crossing the compound, they didn't pay him any mind, which was more evidence that folks cut across the grounds all the time. The workers certainly couldn't have heard him coming over the steady rumble of the power plant. Tom located the generator room without difficulty. He tried an exterior door in the 3-story concrete block building and found it unlocked. It was broiling hot inside the generator room. 600 to 1,000 degrees heat blasted off the foot-diameter steam pipes that jutted from the far wall on his right. Banks of overhead lights reflected on the polished concrete floor and the pale green-painted housings of a row of immense machines. Tom took off his billcap and wiped the beads of sweat from his forehead. Comparing the layout to his memory of the comic book, it was easy to tell which end of the power train was which. Tom walked down the row of machines, looking for the armored conduit that would indicate the power input lines. As he passed the generator, Tom saw a metal warning sign riveted to the housing above a capped valve that stopped him dead in his tracks. Though it was in Spanish, it used the universal symbol for explosion risk. From what he could make of the words, the system contained hydrogen gas under pressure. Essentially, it read, "Extreme danger of explosion. Do not vent." From his reading, Tom knew that hydrogen gas was highly flammable when mixed with air. Given the size of the machine and the fact that the gas was under pressure, there was probably a shitload of it inside. 15 pounds of properly placed C4 could simultaneously breach the generator shell and the pressurized inner chamber and ignite the gas, multiplying the explosive potential big time. The resulting fireball and shockwave would turn the generator, the turbines, and the connecting drive shaft into so much junk. And they were the parts of the system that most likely could not be replaced. They all required precision engineering and metalwork, and large-scale, high-strength castings. He exited the building and retraced his route to the tear in the perimeter fence. As he walked, he did the math in his head, adding up how much explosive it would take to ignite the tank farm, flatten the transformer station, and blow up the generator. 70 pounds of C4, give or take, he figured, would bring the Dark Ages to this little corner of the world. A lesser man than Ryan Carter might have seen his last night on Earth as a preview of Hell's coming attractions. The blistering, hammering heat. The pall of sulfurous yellow light thrown from widely spaced electric bulbs. The gut-wrenching stink of rotting flesh. The carpets of rats merrily scampering down the corridor. The slow trickle of time passing. Ryan watched his double sleep, as naked as a baby, on the damp stone floor. The rats gave their cell a wide berth. There were plenty of other, easier meals to be had. For his part, Ryan didn't sleep at all. He didn't even try. After uncountable hours had passed, Chucho finally stirred from sleep.
Chucho, if there's no lock you can't pick, how about opening my cuffs in the cell door?
Wouldn't do you any good. There's only one way in and out of here, and to get past it, you'd have to defeat the 20 armed red sashes that guard this place. Before you could do that, they'd call for reinforcements from the fort. You'd never see daylight again. And right now, that's my only goal. I've been locked away in this fuckhole for weeks now. I want to see the sun, to feel it on my face one more time before I die.
You're giving up?
Oh, didn't say that. Our best chance is going to come after nightfall, when we're transported from here to the place of execution. They don't have enough red sashes to control the entire route. If we can break through the ranks and make it into the crowds, we've got a slim hope of getting out of this.
Need our hands and feet free to do that. Assuming you can pick the locks on my cuffs, what about yours? They're welded shut.
Chucho turned away for a few seconds. When he turned back, he held the empty cuffs by their connecting chain on a fingertip.
You mean these?
His wrists and the backs of his hands glistened in the electric light. Effortlessly, Chucho popped the cuffs back on.
Rat fat. It is the slipperiest shit on the planet.
At once, Ryan felt a great weight come off his shoulders. If they could get out of this hell pit, if they could both get free, they could at least go down fighting instead of being butchered like hogs.
They're bringing us a hot breakfast, right?
If you want food in this place, you've got to catch and kill it yourself.
12 red sashes lined up in the corridor outside their cell. They stood an arm's length from the bars. 4 of them held nooses on poles. A scowling 5th man, who was apparently in charge, shoved a folded length of cloth through the bars to Chucho and then stepped back out of reach.
The size of my culebra makes these pindic red sashes and priests nervous.
Chucho flashed his white teeth as he wound the material around his waist, covering his nakedness almost to his knees. The other 7 red sashes raised their side-by-side scatterguns as the head guy unlocked the cell's iron door. After the prisoners were made to kneel on the floor, the noose-bearers entered and securely collared them, front and rear. As they worked, Ryan sensed that the guards, despite numbers and firepower, were not all that confident in their advantage. They were dead silent, and he could smell the rank fear in their sweat. Under the circumstances, Ryan had expected the keepers to be arrogant, dismissive, perhaps even contemptuous. But instead, they were walking on eggshells. Ryan and Chucho were led slowly from the cell. A red sash in front and one behind controlled each of them with the poles and the airway-closing tension of their integral garrots. The rest of the escort didn't bracket the 2 prisoners. All 10 red sashes walked on Ryan's left, which gave them a clear firing lane and a stone wall for a pellet and splatter backstop. The entourage gradually spiraled up from the bowels of the Ravelin. There were no stairs to climb, just a slight, gradual grade in the floor.
Hey, Pedro, tu madre es un punta grande.
What the hell?
Without a preamble of shoving or warning shouts, 2 of the red sashes immediately dropped their shotguns and started throwing punches at each other's heads. Before anyone could intervene, the 2 combatants were rolling around on the puddle floor, hands around throats, trying to strangle the life from each other. The leader's face was about as red as his sash.
Stop! Stop them!
4 of the red sashes slung their double barrels and set to pulling the fighters apart. Chucho winked at Ryan with his one good eye.
Voice throwing. A good trick, yes?
Very good trick.
After a brief scuffle with the peacemakers, the 2 still furious men were hauled to their feet. The clearly aggravated red sash leader stationed 1 of them at the head of the line, the other at the end.
Move!
Ryan and Chucho were marched through the Ravelin's foyer, out the prisoner's only exit, into the heat and blazing light of the semi-tropics. From the height of the sun overhead, Ryan figured it had to be close to mid-morning already. The red sashes lined up along the fort's ramparts shook their guns in the air. The procession crossed the bridge over the deep canal that separated the Ravelin and the fort. Looking in both directions down the sheltered waterway, Ryan glimpsed crowds of people gathered on the mainland, wildly waving colored pennants and giant heads on sticks. They entered the fort through the door of the cylindrical guardhouse, passed under the massive ramparts, and stepped out into the broad compound parade ground. To the left, on an elevated platform at the far end of the enclosure, the priests were indeed wearing their judge hats. tall red cones with a matching glittering fringe that hung down over their faces past their chins, like curtains of perpetually spurting blood. Dressed in a gold epauletted white military tunic, the breast laden with rows of bright medals and matching white trousers, Moto oversaw the festivities from a throne behind the judge dancers. Ryan and Chucho were forced marched to the edge of the dais, and there, thanks to the leverage provided by the noose poles, made to kneel in the sun in front of the judges and the Governor General of Veracruz. The red sash audience looking down from the battlements on three sides of the compound absolutely ate it up. Ryan could see the sun flashing off the bottles that were being passed around. The red sashes were getting drunk in the middle of the morning on this very special occasion. Then Spider Priest stepped to the edge of the platform and raised his arms to silence the crowd.
I, Itzamna, the head priest, thank the lords of death for the opportunity to serve them by publicly trying and executing their sworn ancient enemies from the beginning of time.
As the lesser priests took their seats on either side of Modo, Itzamna opened a scroll.
The condemned are accused of disemboweling priests and strangling them to death with their own intestines. The condemned are accused of burning churches to the ground with priests and our holy red guard trapped inside. The condemned are also accused of blowing up garrisons, poisoning wells, stealing treasure and payroll from caravans, and destroying oil pipelines and a refinery. The condemned are also accused of inciting mob violence.
I only did all that when I was sorely provoked.
What about me? I didn't do any of that.
Well, since we're the Hero Brothers, it's sort of a two-for-one thing. You are the Dual Queen, the White Queen. I'm the Indio, the Dark One. Guilt by association, though we're perfect strangers.
So everything you did to these bastards, I'm getting the blame for?
Pretty much. Sorry.
Don't be. If I'd known about any of this, I'd have done the same as you. Maybe a lot worse. How are they going to execute us?
Are you sure you want to know?
Well, I don't plan on being around when it's supposed to happen. I'm just curious about what they have in mind.
It'll be big fun for the priests, but not so much fun for us. First, they'll strip us naked in front of the screaming crowd. Then they'll stick quills through our dicks to draw the sacred blood for fire sacrifice. After burning our blood, they'll hang us by the neck from the lighthouse parapet and revive us. They'll do that a few dozen times until they or the crowd gets bored, whichever comes first. After that, they'll chop off our arms and legs and cauterize the stump so we don't bleed out. Then they'll cut off our male parts and fry them in hot lard right under our noses. When that's done, they'll open our bellies and yard out our guts.
And that's how they chill us?
Chill us. They'll burn us alive.
The spider priest lowered the scroll, stepped to the edge of the dais, and stared at the kneeling prisoners.
Do you have anything to say? Now is the time to confess and plead mercy from the lords of death.
No, not really.
I've got a few things I want to get off my chest.
When Chucho tried to get up from his knees, his guards wouldn't let him. Displaying amazing strength in his thighs, he slowly rose against the power of the noose poles. Unable to lever him back down, they tried to choke him out. His face turned dark with suffused blood. His remaining eye bulging from the pressure, he stared up at the spider priest and pointed at his mouth. The priest impatiently waved for the guards to loosen the nooses so he could speak his final words.
Esta noche yo estaré en el infierno que jode a sus abuelas.
Fearing his prisoners would be killed before the officially sanctioned event, the leader of the guards raced forward, waving at his men. Ryan and Chucho were rushed to cover under the red brick colonnade.
What did you say at the end that pissed them off?
I told them before the night's over I'd be in hell fucking their grandmothers.